The hollow core, why the center cannot hold. There is a peculiar feeling that hangs over life these days. Hard to name, harder to escape. It isn't exactly despair, and it isn't confusion either. It feels more like stepping into a building that looks intact from the outside, only to discover that once inside, the rooms echo. The walls still stand, the lights still work, but the interior, the spaces where people once lingered, argued, reconciled, and learned how to live together, has been quietly stripped. What unsettles people is not simply disagreement, but the sense that disagreement no longer has anywhere safe to go. Politics now presses directly on the chest. Not because people suddenly care more about policy, but because politics has been asked to carry the weight of belonging, morality, identity, and meaning, all at once. When there are no intermediate spaces to absorb conflict, every contest feels total. Losing no longer feels like being outvoted. It feels like being cast adrift. That is the condition this podcast is about. Not polarization as attitude, but hollowing as structure. The erosion of the middle layer of social life, the institutions that once stood between isolated individuals and vast abstractions of state, market, and ideology. Without those mediating spaces, moderation becomes fragile, extremity becomes adaptive, and politics becomes the last place people try to feel held. What follows unfolds in five parts. The first reconstructs the layered social world that preceded modern individualism, not to idealize it, but to clarify what has been lost. The second traces how those mediating layers were systematically thinned and bypassed. The third examines why that hollowing supercharges polarization and turns politics into a site of existential fear. The fourth looks at how technology completes this process by rewarding exposure, speed, and escalation. The final part asks, cautiously and without false optimism, whether anything resembling a livable middle can still be rebuilt, and what kind of discipline that would require. Part 1. The pre-modern stack. Picture Europe around 1750. Not harmonious, not fair, not clean, not especially kind, but densely layered. Life was not organized around the abstract individual as the basic unit of society. You did not wake up as a rights-bearing atom awaiting recognition by a constitution or a court. You woke up embedded, already situated inside a household, a lineage, a parish, a trade, a place. You belonged before you chose, and you were obligated before you consented. The household was not merely private life, it was production and care, authority and shelter, apprenticeship and welfare, all braided together. Grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins were not lifestyle accessories, they were infrastructure. Illness, debt, childbirth, conflict, disability, old age. These were handled first within kin networks, not because people were sentimental, but because there was nowhere else to turn. Dependence was unavoidable, which made accountability unavoidable too. Authority inside the household could be unequal and sometimes cruel, but it was immediate. It had a human face. It could be confronted, appeased, resisted, endured. It was a relationship, not an office. Beyond the household sat the parish or village, another layer of close-range power. The elders and pastors knew who you were, knew your family, knew your failures. They knew where you lived. They baptized your children, buried your dead, mediated disputes, dispensed charity, and enforced norms. Reputation mattered because it lived in the same streets and fields that you did. Shame and support traveled through the same channels. That intimacy could be suffocating. It could also be containing. Correction arrived entangled with ongoing life, rather than delivered as a remote verdict. The community did not merely observe you, it had leverage over you, and in return, it carried obligations towards you. Then came the occupational layer, where it existed in a mature form. Farms, guilds, companies, fraternities of craft. These were not merely economic arrangements. They governed training, entry, standards, discipline. They pooled risk horizontally, providing support in sickness, injury, or death. To be competent was also to be a certain kind of person, judged by peers who shared your daily reality. Disputes were settled inside institutions thick with memory and consequence. Economic life was not frictionless, but it was mediated, and mediation meant conflict had procedures before it had ideology. Only after these layers did the state typically come into view, for most people, and even then intermittently. The crown taxed, conscripted, enforced law at the margins. It mattered, sometimes brutally, but it did not generally educate children, manage healthcare, guarantee pensions, or administer daily life as a continuous presence. To expect a central authority to manage ordinary risk would have seemed not just unrealistic, but incoherent. Political power existed, but it arrived through intermediaries, and that meant it arrived with resistance, negotiation, and delay built into it. None of this was democratic in the modern sense. Political enfranchisement was narrow, stratified, and often explicitly exclusionary. Most people could not vote. Many had little formal say in the laws that governed them. Power was uneven and frequently unjust. Yet authority was layered rather than singular. Household, parish, craft, local magistracy overlapped, competed, and checked one another. No single structure could plausibly claim the whole person. Life was full of constraint, but constraint was distributed. That distribution mattered because it prevented any one authority from becoming total, and it meant identity was never reducible to one allegiance alone. Trust in this world was not broad, it was deep, but narrow. Intense within small circles, wary beyond them. You were known locally, and that local knowing carried both warmth and menace. The point is not to romanticize it. The point is that mediation was unavoidable. Disagreement had places to land that were not immediately political. Conflict could be handled as a dispute inside a household, a quarrel inside a parish, a breach inside a trade, before it became a metaphysical battle about the nature of the world. From the late 18th century onward, this stack begins to flatten. Industrialization demands standardized time, standardized skills, standardized bodies. Factories do not run on kinship or parish obligation, they run on schedules, wages, and interchangeable labor. Villages empty into cities where old structures cannot scale. Apprenticeship gives way to wage labor. Economic life detaches from place and relationship, and once that happens, the old intermediaries lose both their economic function and their moral leverage. At the same time, political power reorganizes itself around the abstract individual. Mobile populations require portable identity, surnames, birth certificates, censuses, records. Interchangeable labor requires standardized schooling. Mass armies require conscription and administrative legibility. Each step can look technical, even humane. Taken together, they form a quiet revolution. The state increasingly deals directly with individuals, rooting around household, guild, and parish. Crucially, this is also the period in which political enfranchisement begins to expand. Voting rights broaden unevenly and often violently across the 19th and early 20th centuries. Yet this expansion does not restore the old mediating structures, it presupposes their erosion. The vote grants formal political equality at the same moment that everyday social power is migrating upwards. You gain abstract voice, just as the non-political institutions that once shaped daily life lose authority. politics rises in moral prestige precisely as other sources of formation thin out. The world wars accelerate everything. Total war demands total administration. Rationing, employment control, population tracking, relocation, even child rearing while parents fight. After 1945, retreat is not merely impractical, it feels cruel. The welfare state formalizes the new arrangement. Pensions replace intergenerational dependence, centralized healthcare replaces parish charity, compulsory education replaces communal moral formation. The bargain is explicit. The state assumes risks once borne by families, churches, and trades, and in return claims direct access to the citizen as an abstract individual. The middle does not vanish overnight. It thins and becomes optional. It loses authority as its functions migrate upward. Central systems scale efficiently and promise fairness, but they dissolve the buffers that once contained conflict and limited politics' reach. Enfranchisement expands, but it expands into a social architecture already stripped of mediation. By the late 20th century, many people live on a stark line, the isolated individual on one end, vast state and market abstractions on the other. Everything in between becomes fragile, elective, and easily exited. This hollowing is not the product of a single ideology or conspiracy, it is the byproduct of efficiency chasing scale, and of democracy inheriting responsibilities once carried by institutions it no longer has. This is where the later return of populism and nationalism become emotionally legible, when place, craft, congregation, and kin cease to bind. The desire for binding does not disappear. It looks for substitutes that can still feel solid. And because the remaining arenas of shared life operate at scale, that hunger migrates upward into politics, where it becomes combustible. The result is not empowerment so much as exposure. You are formally recognized and structurally alone. Power is equal in theory and distant in practice. And the institutions that once translated life into human-scale obligation have become optional, thin, and easy to exit. Part 2. The Great Disintermediation. What finally hollows out the middle is not a single reform, villain, or ideology. It is a slow convergence of forces that all produce the same practical result. Mediation begins to feel like an unnecessary obstacle, inefficient, suspect, a place where bias and friction hide. Over the 20th century, authority doesn't merely centralize. The cultural instinct to tolerate human-scale intermediaries between the person and the system begins to rot. Why bargain with a committee when you can apply a rule? Why endure an imperfect institution when you can bypass it? Why tolerate the slow, negotiated mess of relationship when you can root around it? As mediation weakens, discretion itself starts to look illegitimate. Judgment that is partial, contextual, or quietly exercised begins to register as unfair or opaque. Authority that once relied on ongoing relationship is increasingly expected to justify itself instantly, in full view, to people who have no stake in its repair. What disappears is not only the institution, but the protected space in which judgment could be provisional, where decisions could be made, lived with, and revised without becoming a moral spectacle. Geographic mobility does the first cut because it breaks the basic assumption that makes intermediaries work, that you will still be here next year. A neighbourhood association, a union hall, a parish council. Even a long-running local feud depends on continuity. It depends on favours that return, reputations that stick, and consequences that follow you home. But when success is defined by portability, obligation starts to feel irrational. Education trains for transferability, careers reward movement. Even romance increasingly treats place as provisional. Under high churn, people don't stop being decent. They stop being bound. You arrive, behave politely, extract what you need, and leave. No one can count on you, and you can't count on anyone. The social fabric doesn't tear dramatically. It simply never has the chance to weave. Religion's decline amplifies this in a way that is usually discussed too abstractly, as if the main question were belief itself. In lived reality, congregations performed a more basic social function. They forced proximity across difference and made exit costly. They made you sit beside people you did not choose, week after week, and then live with them afterwards. They trained restraint, not by celebrating tolerance, but denying the fantasy of clean separation. Confession and absolution were not private therapy. They were embedded in a continuing moral world where judgment, mercy, and accountability had faces. When that layer thins, its replacements do not carry the same binding force. Therapy can be intimate without being communal. Philanthropy can be generous without being reciprocal. Online moral discourse can be passionate without being answerable. What disappears is the experience of sharing a moral world with people you did not curate and cannot simply discard. The economic reorganization of family life removes another layer by quietly outsourcing the dependencies that once forced people into one another's lives. As households shift from productive units into consumption and logistics hubs, informal mutual reliance becomes harder to sustain. Childcare swaps, elder care rotations, shared meals, informal supervision, the small daily interlocks that make kin and neighbours real to one another do not necessarily vanish, but they're squeezed, scheduled, and frequently replaced by services. Daycare chains, assisted living facilities, delivery platforms, professionalised care systems step in. On paper, that looks like reliability. In practice, it turns obligation into a transaction. You still receive help, but you no longer have to be entangled to receive it. The quiet knowledge that you will need each other again. The mutual exposure that softens pride, forces compromise, and makes repair more likely than exit gets engineered out. Media then collapses whatever remains of scale and containment. In earlier worlds, conflict moved through layers. Disputes stayed local. Shame and reconciliation happened in front of people who would still see you tomorrow. National politics felt distant by design, not because leaders were noble, but because ordinary life had buffers. Now everything arrives through the same channels at the same emotional volume. A playground argument and a geopolitical crisis compete in the same feed. A local dispute is instantly abstracted, moralized, and recruited into a narrative larger than the people involved. Algorithms do not have a concept of proportion. They have a concept of engagement. The voices that once said, "Handle it here," or "Talk to him directly," or "This too shall pass," are not merely absent. They are structurally disadvantaged. Nothing is allowed to remain small. A conflict that would once have died in embarrassment now finds an audience, a tribe, a vocabulary, and a cause. By the early 21st century, the cumulative effect is decisive. Most people encounter power alone. The market knows them as a spending profile. The state knows them as a category. Platforms know them as data. Between those abstractions, there's almost nothing left with real authority to say, in a human voice, "I know you." I know the situation. And the answer is no, or yes, or not yet. Judgment has not disappeared, but it has been stripped of discretion and exposed to constant visibility. Decisions are made under the expectation that they will be watched, recorded, and reframed, rather than lived with and repaired. Disintermediation presents itself as convenience and empowerment, but its deeper function is surgical. It removes the buffers where human judgment, negotiated norms, and imperfect obligation once lived. What remains is the individual, maximally visible and minimally held, facing systems too large to argue with and too distant to care. Under those conditions, people adapt rationally. Institutions retreat into rigid rules, individuals retreat into silence or certainty, and discretion gives way to defensiveness. And when you meet power this way, alone, abstracted, and exposed, you begin to demand from politics what you once demanded from community. When the middle layer disappears, politics does not simply become more important. It becomes compensatory. It is asked to do the work once performed by families, congregations, trades, and neighborhoods, to tell people who they are, what they owe one another, what is forbidden, what is sacred, and what makes life make sense. That's not a failure of democratic spirit. It's a structural overload. Politics cannot carry that weight without becoming absolute. A partial sphere turns total. A tool for collective decision-making becomes a substitute moral world. Disagreement stops being tolerable because nothing else remains to hold meaning steady while it is worked through. Every loss threatens collapse. Every compromise feels like self-erasure. And every election starts to read as a referendum on reality itself. Part 3. Why this supercharges polarization. The psychological climate that follows is predictable. When most power is distant and impersonal, people become dependent and resentful at the same time. You expect protection, recognition, and moral affirmation from systems you cannot reach. When those systems fail, as they inevitably do, the anger has nowhere to go except outward. Authority feels omnipotent, yet illegitimate. Power arrives without a human face, so it feels both overwhelming and indifferent. A permanent state of grievance becomes normal, and certainty starts to feel like shelter rather than rigidity. What intensifies this condition is that mediation does not simply disappear. It is replaced by exposure. Judgment no longer unfolds inside bounded relationships where context, discretion, and repair are possible. It is forced into visibility, where every action must justify itself instantly to strangers. Authority that once relied on ongoing relationship is now expected to explain itself fully, immediately, and publicly, or else be treated as suspect, corrupt. Under those conditions, ambiguity is dangerous, hesitation looks like bad faith, discretion reads as cruelty or bias, silence becomes complicity. People adapt accordingly. That is the soil in which extremes stop being fringe and start being adaptive. They do not merely offer policies, they offer protection from exposure. They offer moral clarity in a world where nuance is punished and uncertainty is read as betrayal. They convert isolation into loyalty by naming enemies and supplying scripts. They give you a tribe, a grammar, a storyline, a moral map, and they do it without requiring the one thing genuine community requires: proximity to people who might disappoint you, but still have to be lived with. What matters structurally is less the content of the beliefs than the move both sides are pushed toward making. With mediation gone, the only arena that still feels consequential is the arena of scale, so politics becomes the primary site of moral life. Identity collapses onto a single axis. One political position comes to stand in for the whole person. To challenge it feels like an attack on existence itself. There are no secondary loyalties left to soften the blow, no shared daily life insisting that tomorrow you will still need to cooperate. Compromise stops reading as prudence and starts reading as betrayal. The enemy becomes someone you must defeat rather than someone you must continue living beside. This is why the atmosphere starts to feel unlivable. Everything is carrying too much weight. A joke becomes a provocation. A policy dispute becomes a referendum on whether someone deserves to exist safely. People are sorted, scanned, and judged on fragments of belief because there are no longer thick contexts in which to know one another fully. Judgment travels without relationship. Condemnation arrives without obligation. The public sphere fills with intensity precisely because private and communal spheres have emptied out. Politics becomes punitive because it has absorbed functions it cannot perform with patience. It is no longer governing shared life so much as substituting for shared life. All of that can still sound abstract until you notice what it has done to the present tense. We are now in a situation where large numbers of people on both sides privately believe that losing the next few elections could mean the end of the country they recognise. The fear is not metaphorical. It's not experienced as, "We disagree about policy." It's experienced as, "If they win, they will not relinquish power," or, "If they win, they will use the state to punish and erase us," or, "If they win, the border, the courts, the rules, the whole moral order collapses." That is why 2028 hovers like an unspoken deadline. The nightmare is symmetrical. Each camp imagines itself as the last line of defence against tyranny, and each camp can point to enough rhetoric, enough real abuses, enough institutional stress to keep the fear from feeling like hysteria. In that atmosphere, dialogue stops sounding like virtue and starts sounding like surrender. You can hear it in the way Democrats and Republicans increasingly speak as if the other is not mistaken, but illegitimate. You can see it in how Trump functions less as an ordinary politician than as a sorting engine. To some, he's proof that the system can still be smashed in the name of ordinary people who feel governed by distant elites. To others, he is proof that the system can be captured by a man who does not recognize limits, and that capture can be normalized by exhaustion, cynicism, or tribal loyalty. The point is not to adjudicate the whole man here. The point is to notice what he becomes inside a hollowed-out society, a vessel for anxieties that have nowhere else to land. The whiplash from globalization back towards nationalism and populism fits into the same structure. It often reads like ideology, but it is also an emotional demand made politically, because it cannot be made anywhere else. restore borders, restore meaning, restore a sense that someone is in charge, restore the feeling of being protected by something that belongs to us. When place, craft, congregation and kin stop binding, the desire for binding does not disappear. It becomes combustible when the only available substitute is national politics. You see the same dynamic in the way Musk can be read simultaneously as a reckless accelerant of chaos and as one of the few powerful figures willing to say aloud what many people suspect, even when he says it clumsily. This isn't endorsement. It's a description of the gravitational field. In a society with a thick middle, a single billionaire's posture would not need to carry so much psychic freight. In a society that has thinned out its intermediaries, figures like this become screens onto which people project hope, rage, betrayal, and rescue fantasies. Then there are the lived scenes that make all of this feel less like theory and more like emergency. Friends standing outside ICE offices, insisting on the right to protest peacefully because they believe something monstrous is being normalized. Other people arriving not to argue but to intimidate, to shout, to menace, to escalate, because they believe the protesters are collaborators in national dissolution. A death in custody can be narrated as murder on one timeline and as enforcement on another, with such incompatible moral premises that even agreeing on what happened becomes impossible. The same image, the same video becomes evidence of cruelty to one side and evidence of necessary order to the other. This is what it means for politics to become total. Even grief becomes partisan property. Even violence becomes a Rorschach test. Even sympathy is treated as betrayal. None of this requires assuming a sudden collapse of intelligence or goodwill. The same human tendencies, fear, vanity, tribal loyalty, aggression, have always been with us. What has changed is the loss of structures that once slowed them down, forced them into tolerable shapes, and protected judgment from becoming spectacle. When those structures disappear, extremity stops being marginal. It becomes adaptive. Certainty becomes shelter. Purity becomes safety. And a society that cannot metabolize conflict locally starts to experience every national contest as a fight for survival. This is why the centre cannot hold. Not because moderation lacks conviction, intelligence, or moral seriousness, but because the conditions that once made moderation livable have been stripped away. Without institutions that enforce proximity, impose limits, and distribute meaning across many domains, pluralism becomes fragile and politics becomes absolute. That is a failure of architecture more than a failure of ideas. And this is where the next step matters, because the reason the fever doesn't break is not only that the middle is gone, it is that we now live inside systems that reward heat over repair, humiliation over reconciliation, and speed over any slow return to shared reality. Part 4. Digital technology as the final solvent. Technology has always acted as a solvent on social life. That's not a moral claim so much as a structural one. To invent a tool is to remove friction, to make something faster, easier, cheaper, more reliable, or more scalable than it was before. Every major technological shift dissolves some constraint that once shaped how people lived together. The printing press loosened oral authority. Industrial machinery broke the ties between labour and place. Railways collapsed distance. None of these changes were merely technical. Each quietly reorganised time, obligation, hierarchy, and the ways people recognised one another as members of a shared world. In that sense, the hollowing described earlier belongs to a longer technological story. Industrialization did not just reorganize production, it dissolved the social forms that had contained it. Bureaucracy did not simply increase efficiency, it replaced judgment embedded in relationship with rule following at scale. These changes would have been destabilizing even without democracy, mass media, or universal literacy. They altered the conditions under which mediation itself could occur. Digital technology, however, introduces something qualitatively new. The computer, the network, and the internet are not just faster channels led onto existing social life. They are technologies of coordination, attention, and interpretation. They do not merely accelerate communication. They transform how people encounter one another, how judgment becomes visible, and how conflict travels by reshaping the conditions under which meaning is produced. Online, disputes form where their audiences already are. Reputations rise and fall where their traces can be copied. Belonging is signalled where it can be instantly seen. The result is not simply more speech, but a shift in the medium through which social reality itself is made. One of the most consequential shifts is the divorce of content from place. A town square, a church hall, a workplace, or a neighbourhood, even a hostile one, is still a setting with limits. It has edges, pauses, boredom, repetition, and the drag of real time. Words spoken there are embedded in shared histories and carry consequences that persist beyond the moment. Digital space arrives differently, continuously, without boundaries, carrying everything at once. Near and far collapse, relevance and irrelevance blur. Action and reaction become difficult to distinguish. As a result, the basic unit of social meaning changes. In place-based life, the unit was a person over time, contradictory, contextual, and embedded in ongoing relationships. Online, the unit becomes the extract, a sentence, a clip, a screenshot, a gesture torn from its setting. Extracts travel easily. They are legible to strangers. They can be ranked, rewarded, or punished without reference to the life they came from. This is not simply distortion. It is a structural preference for fragments over persons. The world has become meme. That preference reshapes moral life. In bounded settings, judgment unfolded inside relationships where discretion, context, and repair were possible. Mistakes could be addressed without becoming spectacles. Conflict could cool because the people involved would still encounter one another. Digital systems reverse these priorities. Judgment now occurs under exposure. Decisions must justify themselves instantly to an undefined audience. Discretion begins to look like bias. Context sounds like excuse. Silence reads as complicity. Moral action shifts from something worked through in relationship to something performed for visibility. Reputation changes accordingly. In older worlds, reputation was local and sticky. People were known in multiple roles, and those roles constrained one another. Access carried ongoing cost because it followed you. Online, reputation is portable and segmented. Selves can be curated by context, and contexts can be exited instantly. Consequences no longer reliably follow the person who generated them. Escalation becomes cheap. Repair becomes optional. Under these conditions, what spreads most easily is not understanding, but humiliation. Outrage compresses well. It signals allegiance, certainty, and moral clarity in a minimal space. Forgiveness does not. It is slow, specific, and usually private. It requires time, proximity, and a willingness to remain after harm. The machinery of attention has little use for it. The public sphere fills with punishment and thins of reconciliation, not because mercy has vanished, but because mercy does not scale. Digital systems also cultivate an exit reflex: block, mute, unfollow, quit. Each move is often reasonable in isolation and protective in the short term. Repeated often enough, exit becomes a moral habit. Difficulty triggers disappearance rather than metabolization. That habit does not remain confined to online life. It migrates upward. When people imagine political solutions, they increasingly reach for the same logic they have been trained in elsewhere: purge, ban, exclude, purify. What looks like ideological extremism is often an exit reflex translated into political form. A quieter effect intensifies all of this: high visibility combined with low recognition. Digital and bureaucratic systems can see constantly, as profiles, categories, risk scores, data trails, but they cannot recognize in the human sense. They cannot say with authority and context, "I know you, I know what happened, and here is what we will do." Instead, they root people into queues, tickets, automated replies, and faceless enforcement. Being watched without being known reliably generates modern rage. It produces the experience of living under systems that are everywhere and nowhere at once, omnipresent, unanswerable, and indifferent. Taken together, these shifts help explain why the political fever no longer breaks. Digital technology does not create fanaticism, it removes the walls that once contained it. Ordinary human excess, fear, certainty, resentment, righteousness, circulates without friction, correction, or rest. What once burned out locally now spreads globally. What once embarrassed now recruits. What once demanded endurance now rewards exit or escalation. Unlike earlier technological shocks, this one has no natural cooling mechanism. Incentives align toward intensity rather than repair. Platforms profit from arousal. Institutions respond by hardening instead of contextualizing. Individuals, isolated and exposed, learn that ambiguity is dangerous and certainty protective. Each cycle leaves the middle thinner than before. This is why the temperature rarely comes down. Even calm feels provisional, not restorative. Nothing is being repaired in the background. The solvent keeps working precisely because it arrives as convenience, connection, and freedom. Part 5. What can still be held? So this is where the story arrives, not at the edge of disagreement, but at the edge of endurance. For many people, a quiet calculation now runs beneath ordinary life. If the next few years go badly, the world I recognize will not survive. That fear is no longer confined to one ideology or temperament. It appears among protesters and counter-protesters, among those who still trust institutions and those who believe those institutions are already hollow. Political loss no longer registers as calamity, it registers as cataclysm. Fear at this intensity refuses consideration. It demands survival. The reflex to fight, freeze, or flee. It pushes people towards total solutions, toward moral clarity without remainder, toward victory without repair. And because the middle no longer exists to catch that fear and break its fall, politics becomes the place where everything is asked to resolve at once. Restraint starts to look naive. Compromise begins to resemble betrayal. Under these conditions, the problem lies neither in apathy nor engagement, but in their form. In physical space, apathy remains a mode of presence. Online, it disappears. prevailing modes of engagement override context, collapse distinction, and force resolution, operating violently against proportion and context. We are left with non-existence or violence as our only choices. This does not require bad actors or sudden moral collapse, a layered social world thinned, mediation gave way to direct rooting. Politics absorbed functions it cannot carry without becoming absolute. Technology removes the remaining friction. These changes followed from structural transformation, not from the corruption of character, and nothing in the preceding account points towards reversal. The forces at play, scale, mobility, legibility, exposure, are not weakening, they are intensifying. This realization is often where people feel a drop in the stomach. No hope of restoration, no plan to rally around, no promise that the world will return to a form that makes sense again. Only a quickening pace and an environment growing more volatile than any shared framework can hold. Totalizing systems are structurally unstable. By attempting to decide everything at once, they strain their own capacity to see, to respond, and to absorb error. That instability creates pressure points, moments where centralized authority cannot decide in time, cannot see enough, or cannot bear the cost of being wrong. But there is no historical law that says strain returns judgment downward. More often, it concentrates power further. Failure at the center frequently produces hardening rather than devolution. Exhaustion does not reliably restore proportion. It just as often produces withdrawal, resentment, or longing for coercive order. Things do not swing back. They keep breaking in different ways. Still, strain does something else. It creates moments, uneven, temporary, easily erased, where decision does not disappear, but relocates. It moves sideways. Someone acts, others accept or resist the action. Consequences follow. Authority, when it appears, does so after the fact. This is the only form in which anything like a middle can now exist, not as a stable layer of society, and not as a project to be rebuilt, but as patches, bounded spaces where conflict is contained rather than resolved, where judgment is exercised without claiming universality, where decisions persist long enough for consequences to matter. These spaces are not guaranteed to be good. From the inside, they rarely feel inspiring. They feel constrained, imperfect, often disappointing. They involve staying in rooms that no longer promise meaning, only continuity. They will not coordinate with one another. They will not share a program or an ideology. Some will be humane, some will be petty, some will be unjust. There is no mechanism that guarantees moral improvement, and no principle that protects these spaces from capture. What distinguishes them from the surrounding environment is not virtue, it's proportion. Inside them, antagonism does not get to decide everything. Technology does not rescue this process, but it might alter its feasibility, not by granting authority or rebuilding community at scale, but by reducing the cost of non-uniform coordination. Tools that can support memory, context, and interpretation without enforcing outcomes make it easier for local practices to persist. They do not create obligation, they simply stop dissolving it by default. This is not progress, it is reduced acceleration. Nothing about this scales cleanly, nothing about it is safe. These spaces will always lose in the aggregate to movements that promise purity, clarity, and total solutions. And from the inside, choosing restraint over purity often feels like losing. But total solutions collapse under their own weight. What remains afterward is not ideology, it is practice. The only defensible claim left is a limited one. A society remains livable not because it eliminates antagonism, but because it preserves enough places where antagonism does not become absolute. Those places will not announce themselves as the middle. They will not be legible as a solution. They will not be fair. They will simply be the places where people choose to stay, not because they agree, but because leaving would make things worse. That choice is not heroic. It's ethical in a thinner, harder sense, a discipline rather than a virtue. It requires refusing total victory, accepting constraint, and remaining in relation long enough for the world to stay shared.